Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, where we meet to discuss the issue of preserving America's historic legacy with the nation's leader in historic preservation. Appropriately, we are meeting tonight at the historic Petit Trianon in downtown San Jose, a replica of the Petit Trianon on the grounds of Versailles. I'm Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club of California and our chair for this evening. We would also like to welcome radio listeners of WESM-FM in Princess Anne, Maryland. We invite you all to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. It gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce Richard Moe, the 7th president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. He brings to the position a lifelong interest in history and a career-long commitment to public service. A native of Duluth, Minnesota, Mr. Moe graduated from Williams College in 1959 and soon launched the public service career that led to administrative positions in city and state government and the chairmanship of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. During this period, he also received a law degree from the University of Minnesota Law School. In 1972, he moved to Washington to be administrative assistant to Senator Walter Mondale. 5 years later, he was named chief of staff to Vice President Mondale and a member of the Carter White House senior staff. He practiced law in Washington from 1981 until he assumed the presidency of the National Trust in January of 1993. A member of the Committee for the Preservation of the White House and the boards of the Ford Foundation and the Civil War Trust, Mr. Moe was awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Maryland in 1998, recognizing his work in the field of historic preservation. He is co-author of Changing Places, Rebuilding Community in the Age of Sprawl, a study of the causes of urban decline and the use of historic preservation as a tool for revitalization. This was published in 1997, and he's also author of The Last Full Measure, The Life and Death of the First Minnesota Volunteers, A Civil War History, published in 1993. As president of the National Trust, Mr. Moe is responsible for leading the organization in its mission to provide leadership, education, and advocacy to save the nation's diverse historic places and create more livable communities for all Americans. Under his direction, the National Trust has become an outspoken and effective advocate for controlling sprawl, has launched efforts to demonstrate and document the effectiveness of preservation as a tool for community revitalization, and has reaffirmed its commitment to strengthening the organized preservation movement. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest, Mr. Richard Moe, who will speak on taking America's past into the future.
Thank you, Gloria, very much for that very kind introduction, and thank you for having me here tonight. I love being at the Commonwealth Club, but this is the first time I've been at the San Jose Commonwealth Club, and I'm eager to come back. Mayor Ron Gonzalez, thank you for that wonderful tour you gave me today. You know, when Easterners like myself think of San Jose, historic preservation is not the first thing that comes to mind. But that changed for me today, that's for sure. This is a city filled with wonderful historic treasures, and what impressed me so much was not only so many of you are working to save them, but so is the mayor. This is a terrific preservation mayor, I want to tell you. He was committed to this. And as you know, preservation is very much a public-private kind of activity, and I'm so pleased that so many members of the Preservation Action Council are here tonight, too, because it takes everybody together. Feel free to break in with applause anytime you'd like. But it was a great tour, and I saw so much. That Montgomery Hotel, the mayor told me that he moved that personally. Is that true? And the Fox Theater, I didn't see the Jose Theater, but there's so much wonderful activity going on, and it's so energizing. And so stimulating. So I'm delighted to be here. And the trolleys. So many of you here restored the trolleys. Let's have a hand for the trolleys. Right. I'm also pleased to see so many old friends. I'm flattered that my friend Jim Meadows, the director of the Presidio Trust, should come down with his colleague Sherilyn Waddell here. Talk about preservation challenges. The Presidio is one of the great challenges, but they're doing a wonderful job doing that under difficult circumstances. And finally, let me say how pleased I am that so many National Trust members are here tonight. Thank you for your support, and thank you for coming out tonight. I am just delighted to be here in Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, the very name of the place, has the sound of the future in it. With technology revolutionizing the way that we shop, communicate, and do business, we're living, obviously, on the threshold of a whole new world. And the door to that world is opening right here in the Silicon Valley. My message this evening is really very simple. Here in this place, where the future is being born, there's good reason for making sure that the past doesn't die. Here in this place, whose major industry is innovation, there's good reason for preservation. Maybe you're wondering whether historic preservation is at all relevant to the day-to-day realities of life here in Silicon Valley. If that question has occurred to you, it's probably because preservation is not what you think it is. Restoring house museums, that's what many people think of when they hear the word preservation. But that's no longer true. Preservation today is rooted in an appreciation of the value of history, but it's not concerned primarily with the past. Preservation today is in the business of saving special places and the quality of life that they support. This means that in your efforts to build and maintain true livability for all segments of a community's population, preservationists are your friends and your allies. We all need to work together, particularly now that our communities, including the cities and towns of the Silicon Valley, are facing what's probably the worst crisis they've known in a generation, and that's the destruction of livability caused by sprawl. The development of new technologies in transportation and communication has enabled America to do something unique in the history of Western civilization. We've turned many of our cities inside out, scattering industry, commerce, and population all over the landscape, too often leaving ruin and wasted investment in the core. We've called this progress. If that's true, then Ogden Nash was right when he said, "Progress may have been a good thing at one time, but it went on a little too long." The fact is, development that destroys communities isn't progress at all, it's chaos. Winston Churchill said, "We shape our buildings, and then our buildings shape us." And that's true. But the same thing is true for communities. The way we shape them has a huge impact on the way that we feel, the way that we interact with one another, and the way that we live. By harming our communities, sprawl touches us all, and one way or another, we all pay for it. We pay in open space and farmland lost. Here in California, sprawl in the Central Valley alone is expected to affect more than 3.6 million acres of farmland by the year 2040, a disastrous process that will reduce the value of agricultural products by more than $2 billion a year and lead to the loss of nearly 40,000 farm-related jobs. We pay in time lost. According to a Department of Transportation study, American adults average 72 minutes every day behind the wheel. This is more than twice as much time as the average parent spends with the kids. This dismal statistic certainly isn't going to improve anytime soon. In Los Angeles, the average speed on the freeways is expected to drop to 11 miles per hour by 2010. We pay in higher taxes. Over the decades, we've handed over our tax dollars to pay for things like water and sewer lines, schools, and streetlights in our communities. Now we're paying higher taxes to duplicate them in sprawling new developments, while the infrastructure we've already paid for is either abandoned or underused in older neighborhoods. Finally, and perhaps most important of all, we pay in the steady erosion of the quality of life. Older neighborhoods are enclaves of poverty. Tranquil communities are destroyed by road widening. Historic landmarks get demolished and carted off to the landfill. The subdivisions and commercial strips on the edges of San Jose are practically indistinguishable from those surrounding Miami and Cleveland. Every place winds up looking like no place. Sprawl and its byproducts represent the number one threat to community livability in America today. And community livability is the key to community survival. Ruben Morales, CEO of Joint Venture, a nonprofit group of Silicon Valley community leaders, said recently in USA Today, quote, "If we keep Silicon Valley an enjoyable place to live and work, we'll be here a long time." He's right, but it's a very big if, and here's why. New technologies make it possible for people to work practically any place. And if they can work any place, they're bound to pick the best place, the place that offers them the most in terms of livability. This means that in an era of global competitiveness, livability is a key factor in determining which communities thrive and which ones wither. As Robert Solow, the Nobel Prize-winning economist at MIT, says, livability is not some middle-class luxury, it's an economic imperative. Here in California, sprawl's impact on livability has generated a lot of interest lately. You all saw, I'm sure, last month's USA Today article about the nightmarish traffic, skyrocketing housing costs, loss of open space, and other factors that are making it tougher for the Silicon Valley to compete with other high-tech regions from Austin to Boston. That same message was contained in a report on sprawl in California that was issued a few years ago under the auspices of the Bank of America. It states flatly that the, quote, "enormous social, environmental, and economic costs, which until now have been hidden, ignored, or quietly borne by society, have made sprawl a luxury that California can no longer afford." It goes on to say that sprawl has shifted from an engine of California's growth to a force that now threatens to inhibit growth and degrade the quality of life. Now, when the largest bank in the country says that sprawl is bad for business as well as for the environment, people sit up and listen. Sadly, government policies and practices at almost every level, federal, state, and local, often mandate or encourage sprawl. Tax codes are riddled with bias towards new development. Zoning codes prohibit mixed uses and mandate inordinate amounts of parking and unreasonable setback requirements, making it impossible or sometimes even illegal to create the sort of compact, walkable environment that attracts us to historic places all over the world. Even education departments are part of the problem. A big issue nationwide now is what we call school sprawl. The construction of new schools in the middle of nowhere, in locations that children can't walk to and that are too remote to have any meaningful connections to the community where the students live. You're seeing it happen here with the proposal by the Morgan Hill School District to build a new high school in a green belt that separates Morgan Hill from San Jose. One of the reasons school districts build schools in locations like this is that the state education departments too often impose acreage, parking, and other regulations that make it almost impossible to preserve older neighborhood schools. But transportation policy is the worst offender of all. Most road design standards design the pedestrian-friendly layout of small-town main streets and big-city neighborhoods. Even worse, transportation officials keep trying to ease traffic problems by building more roads, an approach which is like trying to cure a hangover by drinking more whiskey. We need to stop emphasizing movement over place, or we run the risk of having no place left. Having an efficient way of getting there doesn't mean much if there isn't worth getting to. Many people think that saving open space is the way to stop sprawl. Making sure that farmland, wetlands, and forests aren't paved over is very important. But we could buy all the open land in the country and still not solve the problem of sprawl. We also need to reclaim the streets and neighborhoods where people live, the towns, inner cities, and older suburbs that we've neglected so badly over the past half century. You can't have smart growth without reinvestment in existing communities. Let me rephrase that. Reinvestment in existing communities is smart growth. Municipalities need financial resources if they are to grow smart. Vacant or underused historic buildings brought back to life are tax-generating assets for a community, as I saw today. That's smart growth. If we expect people to use their cars less and their feet more, the physical environment in which they live, work, shop, and play must have a pedestrian orientation. One of the predominant characteristics of historic areas is their pedestrian orientation, and preserving them is smart growth. Smart growth advocates density and diversity of use. Most older neighborhoods were designed and built with these factors in mind. Saving them is smart growth. Rehabilitation and reuse of older buildings allows for growth without consumption of land. The conversion of a warehouse into 40 dwelling units reduces the demand for new housing on 10 acres of farmland. The revitalization of Main Street reduces the demand for another strip mall. That, too, is smart growth. We've finally begun to realize what sprawl is doing to us. But just talking about it is not enough. What are we going to do about it? The question is not whether our communities will grow. Of course they will. But rather it's how will they grow. In seeking to answer this question, a number of states have recognized the need to provide leadership and assistance on land use planning and revitalization issues. Let me just cite a few of them. In New York, Governor Pataki has appointed a cabinet-level task force to examine state laws and regulations in order to assess their overall impact on community livability. The goal is to root out provisions that work against the creation and preservation of quality communities. Maryland has adopted a program, probably the most significant new program in the country, under which state funding programs that encourage growth, including highways, school construction, sewer and water lines, and location of state offices, are targeted to areas where infrastructure is already in place and where growth has been planned for and can be managed. Local governments can still decide where they want development to occur, but if they opt for a development that will encourage sprawl, they can't assume that state taxpayers will help pay for it. To deal with the issue of school sprawl that I mentioned, state planning and education officials in Maine have jointly issued a brochure called the ABCs of School Site Selection that calls on school districts to consider renovation or expansion of existing schools instead of assuming automatically that new is always best. Select sites where students can walk or bike to school and follow the goals and visions that the community has set forth in its local comprehensive plan. New Jersey has enacted a statewide rehabilitation subcode, a pioneering set of rules for rehabbing old buildings that allows for the retention of historic character while still ensuring safety. The new smart codes, as they're called, have generated a 60% increase in rehab activity across the state and is helping fuel a renaissance in the core of the state's cities and towns. To deal with the issue of local zoning codes that virtually mandate sprawl, Wisconsin last year passed a law calling on the University of Wisconsin to develop a new model code for communities to adopt. This code will be especially useful to local governments that want to manage sprawl but don't know how to do it, or don't have the staff resources to develop their own smart codes. Oregon, as you know, has a strong statewide land use planning law that has been in place since 1993. The law requires every community to calculate the amount of land it needs to accommodate growth during the next 20 years. Then it draws a circle, or an urban growth boundary, around that land and concentrates development within it. The success of this approach has drawn attention in other states, including California. And, of course, San Jose is one of several communities where the city council has approved the creation of urban growth boundaries. This is a commendable step, but piecemeal efforts by themselves are not enough. When you're dealing with sprawl, city limits and county lines are often just irrelevant marks on a map. Limited jurisdiction hampers the ability of local government to deal with an issue of this magnitude. And efforts to control sprawl in a limited area often just shift the problem from one community to another. It's like trying to stop a flood with a picket fence. What's needed is leadership by the governor, the legislature, and others to develop a vision for accommodating California's growth in a smarter way and mechanisms to implement that vision. What's needed is smart growth legislation with teeth in it, legislation that requires local governments to work together in deciding where new development should and should not go, and then targets infrastructure funds to those areas designated for growth. This legislation should favor spending in existing communities first, and ask localities to develop strategies for using already developed land more efficiently. More and more states are moving in this direction, but California is not, and I believe it needs to. Successful people and successful corporations have goals and a plan for reaching these goals. California does not. But it will take people like you asking for state leadership to make it happen. Right now in the state legislature, there are several bills that address pieces of the smart growth issue. And there are several agencies, like the Bay Area Alliance for Sustainable Development, that are working to encourage regional cooperation. These are good efforts and worthy of support, but they would be boosted enormously by the development of a comprehensive statewide approach to the twin problems of sprawl management and community revitalization. California's population is expected to increase by 23 million in the next 40 years, but the state doesn't have a plan to deal with it. That is not only inviting gridlock, I think it's inviting disaster. California has tried a couple of times to enact a statewide growth management law. Those efforts have not succeeded yet, but that shouldn't keep anyone from trying again and again and again. This state has led the nation in so many ways, and now is the time for it to demonstrate leadership again. Establishing a statewide framework that guides growth planning and public spending will make a real difference in the way that Californians live in the present while growing wisely in the future. Failing to do so will mean that Californians are tying their own hands. It could also mean that you're cutting your own throats. We should encourage planning that reduces distances between work and home, that brings mixed uses back to places where they are viable and desirable. Our goal should be an integrated system of planning decisions and regulations that knit communities together instead of tearing them apart. One way to do this is to encourage downtown housing, which I am so pleased to see today encouraged by the mayor and others in this city. Now, obviously, not everyone wants to live in the city, and we shouldn't expect them to. But when people want to, we shouldn't go out of our way to make it difficult for them to do so. 50 years ago, the government began to offer economic inducements to families that wanted to flee to the suburbs. Now it's time to offer similar inducements to entice people to return to or stay in the city. That's why the National Trust is urging Congress to pass legislation called the Historic Homeownership Assistance Act. This legislation would extend federal tax credits to homeowners who renovate their historic homes, giving residents of older neighborhoods incentives to stay and invest in the community's future, and providing an incentive for others to move back into the city. By offering a way to put deteriorated property back on the tax rolls while making homeownership more affordable for lower-income residents, this law could greatly benefit communities all over California. The bill has broad bipartisan support in both houses of Congress. Now, this one act, and we hope it will be enacted this year, but we're not certain. This one act won't solve all of our urban problems, but we believe it can help enormously. I'm convinced that the fight against sprawl is to us in the preservation movement what the fight against urban renewal was to an earlier generation of preservationists. And I'm convinced that the answer to sprawl is sound land use planning and reinvestment in older communities. How can we make that happen here in Silicon Valley? Well, the pieces are already in place. You certainly don't need to be convinced of the seriousness of the problem. You experience it every time you're forced into your car to run even the simplest errands, every time you pass a boarded up building that could be put to good use, every time you see open space being bulldozed for another office park or shopping center, just like the one next door. You have historic resources that are well worth saving and that have enormous potential for reuse, again, as I saw today. Touring San Jose, I was greatly impressed by what I saw and heard. And although I didn't see it, I was very excited to hear the proposed conversion of the old Del Monte plant number 51 for residential use. Historic industrial buildings like this cannery have been converted to desirable housing in cities all over the country, and it's wonderful to see it happening here as well. You have very good public officials who support preservation and smart growth. Mayor Gonzalez has just won an award as Legislator of the Year from the California Preservation Foundation for his leadership in revitalizing downtown San Jose, and saving landmarks like the Jose Theater and the Montgomery Hotel. And I saw today why he was given that award. And State Treasurer Phil Angelides last year issued a special report called Smart Investment that calls for state investments that support livable communities, sustainable development, and sound environmental policies, and emphasizes the need for reinvestment in existing communities. You have encouraging evidence of corporate support for smart growth. Generous contributions from local corporations have helped create the Housing Trust Fund of Santa Clara County, which is committed to the provision of affordable housing. Corporate gifts have also helped support economic revitalization projects undertaken by the Community Foundation of Silicon Valley through its Neighborhood Development Initiative. Finally, you have plenty of allies, including a big community of preservationists. Now, my definition of a preservationist is someone who is concerned about the rootlessness and erosion of community that threatened the very foundations of our society, someone who wants to maintain a connection with the past, who feels the need for a tangible link with something real, something solid, something meaningful. There are lots of preservationists out there, including a great many who would never think to pin the label on themselves. And they're your allies in the fight to enhance the quality of life. As I said, all the pieces are in place, and what's needed is the will. Let me tell you about a recent news story. It described a high-tech firm in Baltimore that decided to attract skilled workers by marketing its unique office space in a renovated historic factory building. The strategy has been very successful. Workers looking for something extra appreciate the fact that their workspace is not a dreary cubicle so typical of suburban office parks. They also like the fact that the office is located downtown within walking distance of apartments, shops, and restaurants, instead of in a suburban location at the end of a long commute. The end result is that a historic building has been given new life, an urban neighborhood has been strengthened, and a company and its workers are happy. And again, I saw evidence of that today. It's all about choices. Those high-tech workers in Baltimore are making a choice about the kind of environment in which they want to work and live. Now, communities can make choices, too. We can choose where to make investments. If we allow government to keep pouring funding into more highways and more suburban infrastructure, sprawl will continue to spread like an epidemic. But if we insist that government make a commitment to a reinvestment in existing communities, it can make an enormous difference. We can choose to let highway engineers and sprawl builders do our planning for us, or we can take a more active role ourselves. We can keep on accepting the kind of communities we get, or we can take steps to ensure that we get the kind of communities that we want and need. I use the word need deliberately because I'm convinced that preserving our heritage is essential in meeting a fundamental human need, and that's the need for roots. When we save older buildings and neighborhoods, we strengthen a partnership that makes for orderly growth and change in our communities, the perpetual partnership among the past, the present, and the future. This partnership encourages each generation to build in its own style, to meet its own needs by taking advantage of the very best of contemporary thought technology. But it also recognizes that we can't afford to reject the history, the traditions, and the values on which our lives and our futures are built. When this partnership falls apart, connections between generations of Americans are broken, and blank spaces open up in our understanding of the long process that made us who we are. But when it's allowed to work as it's supposed to, this partnership strengthens the sense of continuity that one historian says is part of the very backbone of human dignity. This partnership is important everywhere, but it's especially critical in a fast-growing, fast-changing place like the Silicon Valley. Keeping this partnership alive and healthy is the very best gift that we can give to the generation that will follow us. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard Moe, President of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, for your remarks and that thought-provoking connection between dealing with sprawl and community revitalization. Now, I would like to introduce Sherilyn Waddell, who will lead the question and answer portion of the program. She has almost 25 years of experience in the identification, protection, and treatment of historic and cultural properties, and is manager of preservation compliance at the Presidio Trust, responsible for the protection of the almost 500 historic buildings and archaeological sites at the Presidio of San Francisco, the former Army base that is being rehabilitated as a sustainable national park. Sherilyn?
Thank you, Gloria Duffy, our chair for this evening. Dick, I want to tell you what a delight it is, an honor to be on the same podium with you as president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Many of you may not realize what a dear friend Dick Moe has been to the heritage of California. At the time I was the state historic preservation officer, Dick Moe and the National Trust were one of the first to call following the Northridge earthquake with concern and aid to go to our federal legislators, go literally to the White House to find funds to repair the buildings, the historic buildings, including the Los Angeles Coliseum that were damaged so badly at that time. And I know that he would be the first to call again should that occur in San Jose or San Francisco. And I want to thank you. Mr. Moe, we have a large number of questions for you from our audience this evening, so let us begin. In Silicon Valley, where sprawl has literally become a way of life, how do you propose that we control this chaotic process and promote preservation?
I could refer to the speech that I just gave, I suppose. Well, obviously, you have taken steps, and I tried to learn more about this today by the urban growth boundary that San Jose adopted unilaterally some years ago, and I gather there's an effort perhaps to put that on the ballot, to strengthen that, to reaffirm the commitment to that. I think that's a very positive step. I was very interested to learn from the mayor today that you have the first green belt, and I think the largest green belt, of any city in California, which is obviously a very significant step and worth preserving. The whole concept of urban growth boundaries and green belts is not just that you save open space, but that you force and compel growth inwardly, and that means more density. That's basically the story of Oregon. That's the story of Portland. Now, they've had 25 years' experience with it, and it hasn't worked perfectly, but it has worked better than just about any other statewide program in the country. What it means is that you can tell the difference between an urban and a rural area because there's a very specific line of demarcation. It also means that you have smaller lot sizes, but you have the density that makes possible light rail, which makes it possible to have a dramatic increase in the number of people working downtown, but not one new parking space added in the last 20 years. I mean, these are remarkable accomplishments. There is no easy answer to this. I really do believe that in spite of the very commendable efforts that you are taking here in San Jose and that the mayor is taking, it's really not possible to be successful in this effort unless there is a statewide effort. Now, you can argue about what the different kind of statewide effort ought to be, but you can't deal with this in a vacuum. These political boundaries are arbitrary, and growth does not respect them. The growth will transcend them. So it really has to happen, as I tried to suggest, in a larger context.
Mr. Moe, how can people who are interested in preservation work most effectively to influence the political process?
The preservation movement has evolved in many ways. As I indicated, we started out being focused solely on house museums, but in the 60s and 70s, we at the Trust became very programmatic, and we also became an advocacy organization. And that means that we advocate for preservation policies and practices at the federal, state, and local level that we think will facilitate the work of preservation. We haven't always done this, but we're doing it very vigorously now. And as I mentioned in my remarks, we're working hard to enact this Historic Homeowner Assistance Act. But it's also very important to be advocates at the local level. And that's why I'm so pleased that the Preservation Action Council that's represented here tonight believes in advocacy, because you're having an effect. The mayor told me today that you've been a wonderful partner. That's advocacy at the local level. And we need more people involved in these kinds of organizations. I hope you will all join the council and help them in their work. They're a partner of ours. That is advocacy that will make a difference.
What economic benefits does historic preservation offer this country?
That's a really good question, and it has now been clear. The answer has now been clear. But study after study has demonstrated that more jobs are created through preservation rather than new construction, both construction jobs and permanent jobs. It's also clear that the designation of historic districts almost always will raise property values. So the economic benefits are pretty apparent, I think, in most cases. Sometimes it's still necessary for tax incentives or credits like the ones that we're arguing for to make the final economics of a preservation package work. But the economics increasingly do work. And one of the reasons why there's so much terrific preservation activity going on, again, much of which I saw today, is that there is now in this country a group of developers who not only get it, but who get the economics of it, who can figure out how to make the numbers work for preservation. And that was true in those buildings that we just saw, and it's true all over the country. That hasn't always been true. I think there's a convergence now of forces. I'm not quite sure how to articulate this, but let me try. For a long time, we were in the preservation movement trying to prevent bad things from happening, trying to prevent historic structures from being torn down. That still occurs, and we still have to guard against that. But increasingly, we are working proactively with developers and with city officials and with others to try to use the historic assets of a city in ways that maybe weren't originally intended, but that can serve the city again. And the reduction of crime in most cities has made it possible now for those who want to live in urban areas to do so. There is still a major problem in most cities with schools, and crime and schools are the two threshold issues for people who want to live in urban areas. But if you're empty nesters or single and aren't concerned about schools, urban living is now an option, and it wasn't as recently as 10 years ago. Also combined with the economy and with the fact that the developers can figure out how to do this, I think is leading us into what I might call the golden age of preservation. I think this kind of activity that I saw here in San Jose today is happening in virtually every city in the country. And it wasn't happening 5 or 10 years ago. And I think it's one of the most encouraging and positive developments. It's even happening in Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles in February, and I went downtown. I hadn't spent a lot of time downtown. Well, as you know, it's empty downtown. There's nothing there. There are no people there. But there are wonderful buildings there. There are 200 historic buildings in downtown Los Angeles that developers in anywhere else would die for. But there is one developer by the name of Tom Gilmore who has leapt in courageously, got the financing, God knows how, but he's restoring some of these buildings for loft apartments, and there's immediate demand. But, of course, the banks and the others down in Los Angeles say, no, people don't want to live downtown. People want to live out, 50 miles away so they can drive downtown every day. But they don't. I mean, people are changing their views about this, and increasing numbers of people are attracted to urban living. If those 200 buildings were restored for residential use in downtown Los Angeles, you would have a community of 50,000 people. Well, think of all the open space you could save with that kind of development. So I think there's a lot to be encouraged about. I hope I'm not overstating this, but as long as this economy holds up, knock on wood, I think we have reason to be hopeful.
And I understand, Mr. Moe, that the National Trust for Historic Preservation is having their annual preservation conference in Los Angeles. So that should be some testament that there's plenty to see and do related to historic preservation the first week in November this year. How can community preservationists combat the property rights argument? This is now a major problem in Palo Alto, which recently had a vote on a historic preservation ordinance that was turned down by the popular vote.
That's a good question. I'm not intimately familiar with what happened in Palo Alto, but I gather by a fairly narrow margin a preservation ordinance was defeated. And now people on both sides of that question, I gather, are working to try to find some kind of voluntary way to save the preservation resources of Palo Alto, which I drove through today. It's a wonderful, wonderful community. I hadn't really seen it before. We have always respected property rights in this country, and property rights deserve respect. But it has never been true in this country that we were entitled to do whatever we want with our property. There's always been a recognition in tradition and in law that we are the stewards of property for a given period of time, but it's a temporary thing. And it's also been recognized that there is a community value to be recognized where property is concerned, that property rights are not absolute, that community values have a right to be expressed too. And I think that's what was on the ballot in Palo Alto, if I understand it correctly. These are values that come into conflict in different ways and in different places and at different times. As I say, property values deserve respect, but they don't deserve, I think, I gather the issue in Palo Alto is this business of teardowns, if I understand that correctly. This is an issue that is not unique to Palo Alto. It's unique to a lot of very wealthy communities. It's true at Nantucket. It's true in Martha's Vineyard. It's true in Aspen, Colorado. It's true in a lot of places. People are coming in to historic districts, tearing down maybe not great houses, but houses that contribute to the historic character of a district, and putting up something much larger, much and out of character, in ways that destroy the character of the district as a whole. Well, I think a community is entitled to say this is an important district and we want to retain its character. Now, the people of Palo Alto clearly didn't agree with that by a narrow margin, but there are other ways to approach this, and I hope they find a way to do it in Palo Alto.
Mr. Moe, do you have any tips about running an historic preservation organization?
Well, I came to this totally unexpectedly and fairly late in life. I never dreamt of running a preservation organization. I was in politics and government and practicing law, and I was bored practicing law, frankly. I wasn't meant to be a lawyer, so I wrote a book about the Civil War. And in the course of researching that, discovered how threatened so many Civil War battlefields were and got involved in a Civil War battlefield organization. And then that was kind of a short skip and a jump over to the National Trust. But it was all very serendipitous. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I feel so privileged to be the president of the National Trust. This is a great organization. Many of you are members. I thank you again for your support. We're trying to do important work. I think we're at an important point in the history of this country where we can make a difference. I think people are increasingly appreciating their heritage and the value of preserving that heritage in ways that we haven't before. Let me just give you a couple of examples. One of the great threshold events of the preservation movement of history was the destruction of Penn Station in New York City in 1962. Yeah, that was a great structure that was lost and was lost unnecessarily. It became the catalyst for the preservation movement to be born in New York City and indeed beyond. The same thing was true a decade later in Chicago when the great Sullivan and Adler Chicago Stock Exchange was was demolished. And we could go on and on. Many very significant architectural and historical structures were lost back in those years. I don't think they would be lost today. If Penn Station were threatened today, I don't think it would be lost. And this is one of the things that I find most encouraging about. I know I'm straying from the question, but I'd rather answer this question. It's a trick I picked up in politics years ago. Answer the question you want to answer. I really believe that there is an increased value system in the American people, and that we attach greater importance to this sort of thing. Now, you may have followed a controversy in Reno earlier this year where we lost the Mapes Hotel. We'd put the National Trust has a list of endangered places it lists every year, and several years ago we put this marvelous Art Deco hotel, the Mapes Hotel. Well, the city tore it down, and we lost it. So occasionally we get into battles like that, but not anywhere near as often as we used to. It really has changed a lot. The answer is I don't have any tips for anybody to run preservation organization.
In a bold move, the National Trust gave up all federal funding 2 years ago. Could you outline how the Trust is replacing that funding and some specific ways individuals and organizations could participate in future initiatives?
What a wonderful question. The National Trust was chartered by the Congress 51 years ago, basically to run a number of house museums. As I mentioned, we've broadened our mission ever since then. Starting in the 1970s, we received very significant federal funding to the point where in 1995 we received $7 million from the Congress, and we had a total budget of about $35 million. Well, this was the year that they attempted to cut off funding for a lot of cultural organizations that were receiving federal funding, like the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, National Public Radio, and so forth. And they went after our funding as well. They didn't get it all, but they got half of it. And we had to make some serious decisions. And basically what we did is we stepped back and asked ourselves, do we want to keep going down this road of having to come up to the Congress and fight for this funding every year? We decided we did not. And we decided to go private. And we have done that. And we have just finished our first full year without any federal funding after 27 years, and it feels very good. And we're going to make it. But it means we have to raise a lot more money privately, but we are doing that. We're finding that there are people willing to support us, particularly our members, and we'd be grateful for anyone who wanted to. I don't know if we have any membership brochures here, but we can certainly, if you want to give us your name and address, we will get to you, I can assure you. We've had to broaden our reach, obviously. We've increased our foundation funding by some 500%. We're in the midst of a $105 million capital campaign to add to our endowment and to support our programs. It's all coming together. We're making it work. But mostly we feel good about it because we're independent and we are changing our culture and we're operating differently. We're kind of reinventing the National Trust as we go through this process. And it's a very positive thing. It's a lot of hard work, but it's a very positive thing.
Mr. Moe, how do you think the technology, such as computers and internet, such as that found in Silicon Valley, help with historic preservation?
In a couple of ways, but I guess the basic answer is that I think it's yet to be seen how this will affect. In one very positive way, and the mayor and I talked about this earlier, most new startups, most new small businesses are initially housed in older buildings because the rent's cheaper and they're transitional. And I think it offers a lot of utility for older warehouses, older buildings of all kinds for startups. The other element of this, and I referred to this briefly in my remarks, is that technology now affords people the opportunity to live and work wherever they want in many cases. And many people now have the option of living in historic places that they didn't have before. And there are examples of this all over the country where people locate their businesses in small towns, for example, and set up their businesses above the stores in Main Street. Or they go to I spent a lot of time in Colorado, and they go to these mining towns and set up there. So it gives people a range of options. And increasingly, I think people are finding historic places of different kinds, whether they're urban or small town, to locate. It's also offering residents, or I should say merchants on Main Street, the opportunity to compete more effectively with some of the larger retailers by being able to make their goods and services available on the Internet. We're finding this through our Main Street program. So those are a few instances, but I'm sure there are more.
Related to your discussion on sprawl, isn't being against sprawl elitist? How can you deny young families affordable housing in outlying areas where such housing is cheaper?
Affordable for whom? That's the question. The land is cheaper, but it requires new infrastructure, and we all pay for that. And usually when the infrastructure, when the roads and the schools and the services are paid for, we all pay for that. So the full burden of these new communities, in most cases, is not on the new homeowner. If they were, it would be a different story in many cases. As I tried to indicate earlier, we're basically wasting or underusing the value of the infrastructure and the schools and the facilities that we already have in place. So I don't think there's anything elitist about it. This is something that affects us all. And I think everybody's affected by this one way or another. And we need to come to grips with it.
You mentioned the subject of where schools are located. Is this an issue that the National Trust is actually working on, and if so, how?
Yes, it is. It's a relatively new issue, and as I mentioned in my remarks, it's because states often place acreage requirements on schools or design requirements or parking or something that argues for new construction rather than using older schools. And what we've been trying to do in recent years is to work with a few states, particularly Pennsylvania and Maryland, to adapt those criteria for older schools so that it is possible to preserve the use of neighborhood schools. If you agree that there's a value to neighborhood schools where kids can walk to school and have an identity with the school and it be part of a neighborhood, then I think we need to make it possible to do so. And what we need to do is to take a look at some of the regulations that states impose on education, on school districts, to see whether or not they're really realistic. And in many cases, they are not.
How do you convince a property owner with an old two-story building to pay to renovate rather than sell or develop it with a new higher density development?
I'm not sure. Could you please repeat the question?
How do you convince a property owner with an old or two-story building to pay the cost of renovating it rather than selling it for a higher density development use?
Oh. Well, what's required, I think, is a combination of things. You need to persuade that property owner that there's value in that building. And obviously this is an abstract question, but I'm assuming that there would be value in the building. And sometimes you need to bring financial incentives to the table. Through tax credits or tax increment financing or something to make that possible. If it's important to preserve the character of that streetscape, and it often is. We have just recently, this is getting a little bit off the subject, but it's somewhat related. We've recently been doing a battle with the chain drugstores who have, particularly in the Northeast, but that's happened all over the country, where the chain drugstores have come in and targeted what we call the corner of Main and Main. It's a strategic corner in small and middle-sized towns, where they oftentimes have bought up and destroyed an historic building on the corner so that they could put up a formulaic cinder block drive-through drugstore that totally changes the character of downtown. And we put this corner of Main and Main on our 11 most list last year, and we brought a lot of attention to the issue, and more importantly we've been talking to the chain drugstores, and we're making some progress, and I'm hopeful that in the near future we can make an announcement that we've made some real progress. But that's the kind of thing I think, and by talking to groups like this, they can see the value. I mean, for example, when you're dealing with companies like this, you're dealing with real estate people, for the most part, who are solely concerned about the bottom line. But somewhere else in that company, there are people we found that do care about preserving the historic character, or at least they don't want to be wrapped for tearing down historic buildings. And sometimes it's carrot and stick here, so you use whatever's available. But there are means of persuading people that it's worth preserving older buildings.
We have time for one final question, and that question is, the entire image of California, and especially Silicon Valley, revolves around being young, new, and innovative. How does historic preservation fit in?
Again, I refer you to my speech. there are historic districts, there are historic communities, there are historic buildings all over this place. You know that better than I do, and I saw many of them today. I saw them in Palo Alto. I saw them here in San Jose, and I'm sure they're in many more communities. There's nothing, even though Silicon Valley is known for its technological innovations and looking to the future, there's no question but that you have a good part of our heritage right here. I think it's obvious that there are at least some people here who care about preserving that heritage. I think a lot of people care about preserving that heritage, even though the issues tend to be different. I think California gets a bum rap from the rest of the country in terms of some of the perceptions that are cast its way, because I've spent enough time here to know that Californians care a lot about their heritage. And it's not just in San Francisco. It's throughout the state, and it's certainly true here. And I just want to tell you what a privilege I believe I've had to come here and see it firsthand, to be able to walk it with the mayor and to talk with so many of you. You do have a wonderful heritage, and I urge you to do the best by it. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Richard Moe, President of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, for joining us and making, shall we say, a historic visit to San Jose. Thank you, Sherilyn. Thank you, Mayor Ron Gonzalez. Thank you, Commonwealth Club members and non-members in our audience here at the Petit Trianon in downtown San Jose. And thank you to our radio listeners. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is now adjourned.
Thank you very much.
We'll remember this for a long time.
Well, I'm glad to get you in